Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, August 4th, 2022. And this is Peter Welch. I am your narrator, and you are listening to the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, also known as IRIS. County COVID plan recognized. Pottawatomie County earns two awards for vaccination program. Pottawatomie County was recognized by the National Association of County and City Health Officials with a Bronze Innovative Practice Award for its COVID-19 vaccination program. The award is presented to local health departments that demonstrated effective community partnerships and collaboration, adaptability, resilience, and innovation, working alongside and serving our community at the mass vaccine clinics was an amazing experience, Public Health Administrator Maria Seek said in the press release. We built relationships with the individuals that make up our community and came together as a team. Once the COVID vaccines were available, the Pottawatomie County Public Health Department, led by its public health leadership team, organized a number of free mass vaccination clinics throughout the county. The clinics ran from December 2020 to May 2021, and saw more than 55,000 doses distributed to about 30,000 area residents, according to an expression of community and an after-action report that summarized the county's efforts. The involvement of county residents proved essential in ensuring that the clinics were staffed and supported by local volunteer, nonprofit, and business communities, as well as elected officials and employees from other county departments. As a board, we are always considering the safety of county residents, and COVID-19 really highlighted this, Supervisor Scott Belt said. The mass vaccine clinics became a community event where the community organizations and businesses all contributed to ensure it was a positive experience available to all the residents. The Pottawatomie County Public Health is one of 10 local health departments from around the country to receive the Bronze Award at NACCHO's annual meeting held in Atlanta, Georgia last month. The organization also presented 10 silver and 4 gold awards. Local health departments have demonstrated remarkable innovation and resilience to better the health of their community during the pandemic, and the 2022 Innovative Practice Awards highlight the very best practices, NACCHO CEO Lori Trammell Freeman said in the press release. Winners excelled at various disciplines, including promoting health equity, contact tracing, mobile testing, contactless medication delivery, and many more. NACCHO is very proud to join them in honoring the outstanding work done by local health departments in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Winning projects were determined through a competitive peer-reviewed process and will be added to NACCHO's Innovative Practice Searchable Online Database. There are other local health departments can review these best practices and adopt them for use in their local community. The NACCHO Award is the second national recognition Pottawatomie County has received for its COVID-19 vaccination plan in May. An expression of community received an achievement award from the National Association of Counties, which are given out to honor innovative, effective county government programs that strengthen services for residents. NACCHO represents the nation's nearly 3,000 local government health departments. These city, county, metropolitan, district, and tribal departments work every day to protect and promote health and well-being for all people in their communities. For more information about NACCHO, visit www.nacccho.org. DEAL reduces barriers for students. UNI partners with Iowa Community College. A new agreement between University of Northern Iowa and Iowa's community colleges will make it easier and more affordable for community college graduates to earn bachelor's degrees. Starting this fall, Iowans with an associate degree from any Iowa community college will be able to earn a UNI online degree without having to leave their hometown, according to a press release from UNI. The UNI at IACC initiative offers a pathway for Iowans who hold an associate's degree from any community college to pursue a bachelor's degree in several high-demand areas: management, businesses and organizations, management of businesses administration, criminal justice, elementary education, human services, technology management, and the Bachelor of Liberal Studies. To put a bachelor's degree within reach, UNI is also launching the Future Ready Scholarship Program to eligible participants and a UNI at IACC program. The Future Ready Scholarship comes with 2 years of eligibility and covers the difference between UNI and community college tuition. Information about the program and how to apply can be found at iacc.uni.edu. I applaud UNI's forward thinking to create greater opportunities and expand access to higher education, said Governor Kim Reynolds. This innovative program provides students with the convenience of attaining a 4-year degree without having to relocate to UNI. Through partnership with community colleges across Iowa, UNI at IACC meets students right where they are in their rural communities, removing barriers that may have prevented them from pursuing higher education. UNI at IACC brings the personalized touch that defines a UNI education to adult learners throughout our state, said UNI President Mark Nook. One of the UNI's greatest strengths is our ability to identify and remove barriers to access and success that many learners face. UNI at IACC represents a major leap forward to assure access for more Iowans through this dynamic and innovative program that leads to in-demand careers in their hometown. Many thanks go to Governor Reynolds and her staff for their support of this important project that will improve the lives of Iowans across the state. We are truly educating Iowans for Iowa. And in other news, Ernst switches vote, helps pass bill. Marion, mom of deceased veteran, calls vote poetic justice. The month of August has taken on a new meaning for Christy Castile of Marion, one marked now not only by sorrow, but poetic justice. I looked up the definition, and it means fitting or deserved retribution for one's actions, and felt how true is that for every one of the soldiers there who encamped out at the U.S. Capitol and have been impacted, Castile said. Facing increasing pressure from Democrats and veterans advocacy organizations, the U.S. Senate passed a bill late Tuesday expanding health care and disability benefits for millions of veterans exposed to toxic burn pits. The Senate passed the measure 86-11, with Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley in favor. Ernst, a combat veteran, had previously objected with some of other Republicans to a budget provision in the bill, which briefly blocked its passage. Castile said explanations given for objecting didn't make sense to her and seemed like a distraction. Not knowing 100% what caused them to change their minds, I have to say I'm glad that they did, she said. It's been the right thing to do from the beginning, and they've done what is right, and I'm just very happy about that. Democratic President Joe Biden has pushed for the legislation and is expected to sign the bill into law. Ernst switches vote again. Castile's late son, Joshua, died in August 2012 at age 32 of lung cancer. His family believes was caused by toxins from the burn pit at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison, where he served as an interrogator from 2004 to 2005. August is the month Joshua passed away, and is always a month that is difficult, and is always a difficult month, Castile went on to say. This is something that I can be happy about. This adds a different meaning to August for me. She added her son, where he still, if he were still alive, would feel the same. One of the last things he said was we would work towards eliminating the potential of using burn pits ever again, just knowing the hazardous nature of them. And it's happened, Castile said. For that, I am grateful. Tuesday's vote ended a brief stalemate when the process derailed after some Senate Republicans, including Ernst, made a late attempt last week to change a budget provision in the bill and blocked it from advancing, infuriating veteran advocacy groups. A key voting block in the November midterm elections, the advocacy groups ramped up the political pressure over the last 5 days on GOP lawmakers to act. The Honoring Our Pact Act first passed the Senate in June 84-14, and by 342-88 votes in the House. But technical corrections sent the measure back to the Senate for another procedural vote July 27th. 25 Republicans who supported the previous version of the bill, including Ernst, changed their vote over how the government accounts for spending slated for veterans programs. The bill projected to increase federal deficits by about $277 billion over 10 years and does not include offsetting spending cuts or tax increases. When the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office scored the bill, it projected that nearly $400 billion slated to be spent on health services would move from discretionary to mandatory spending. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a nonpartisan fiscal watchdog, said a reclassification of the $390 billion from discretionary to mandatory spending would both reduce the pressure to keep those costs under control and make it easier for appropriators to spend more elsewhere in the budget without offsets. Those dynamics, however, also applied to the bill when Senate Republicans had overwhelmingly approved the measure in June. More Iowa veterans exposed to toxins during their military service will qualify for benefits and have an easier time having claims processed under recently passed federal legislation, according to the Iowa American Legion. We're happy to get additional coverage for veterans with respiratory issues and essentially get them the compensation they deserve for the exposure to the chemicals and toxins they were exposed to during their military service, said John Derner, Department Adjutant of the American Legion of Iowa. And in other news here in the state of Iowa, first probable case of monkeypox has been reported. The Iowa Department of Public Health has confirmed the first probable case of monkeypox in Pottawatomie County, according to a statement released Wednesday afternoon by Pottawatomie County Public Health. Pottawatomie County Public Health is working closely with IDPH to conduct contact tracing. PCPH is also communicating with local health partners to identify anyone who may be at risk due to close contact with the patient while infectious. People who have been confirmed to have been direct close contact are instructed to watch for symptoms of illnesses and are often a vaccine series. The series is used to prevent symptoms from developing or developing severe illnesses. Monkeypox is a viral infection that can spread through skin-to-skin contact, body fluids, or shared items such as clothing and bedding that have been contaminated with fluids or sores of a person with monkeypox. The press release stated that the virus can also be spread through respiratory secretions during prolonged face-to-face contact or during intimate physical contact, such as kissing, cuddling, or sex. Although monkeypox is not generally considered a sexually transmitted infection, it can be transmitted during intimate contact and sex by skin-to-skin and other intimate contact, regardless of gender or sexual orientation. People with monkeypox sometimes develop a flu-like illness with fever, fatigue, and enlarged lymph nodes, followed by a characteristic rash. In other instances, people just develop a rash with or without swollen lymph nodes, which can occur in localized areas, such as the genitals and or around the anus. People usually develop monkeypox 7 to 14 days and up to 21 days after being exposed. PCPH encourages the following individuals to call and seek guidance from their medical provider. Recently traveled to an area where monkeypox cases were reported and you have symptoms of monkeypox, especially if you have a rash or lesions, you can find a list of the countries where monkeypox has been reported on the CDC website, cdc.gov/monkeypox/response/2022/world-map.html. People who have symptoms of monkeypox, particularly the characteristics are of rash or lesions, contact with a confirmed or suspected monkeypox case. Healthcare providers should continue to maintain vigilance and consult with their infection prevention support or Pottawatomie County Public Health with any questions or concerns. Because of the hot weather that we've had, I want to mention the forecast so you can take proper precautions. The forecast for the rest of the week will be cooler than the rest of the week, but it's still going to be hot. Today will be sunny with a high near 91, according to the National Weather Service. Tonight will be clear with a low around 67. On Friday, it will be sunny, high around 95. On Friday night, it will be cooler at 75. Saturday, there may be a chance of a shower. And on Saturday night, a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Sunday, a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Sunday night, a slight chance of showers. Monday, a slight chance of showers. Monday night, also a slight chance of showers. And Tuesday, sunny with a high near 88. Again, not quite as hot as it has been. Now let's turn to the environment on our news program here today. How to help monarch butterflies. The beloved butterfly species is in trouble, and here's what you can do about it. Close your eyes for a moment and imagine a butterfly. My money says that the fluttering insect that you envision has black-veined reddish-orange wings outlined with white specks. The iconic attributes of our beloved American monarch butterfly. Unfortunately, the species, which populates many childhood memories, is in trouble. The migrating monarch butterfly was added recently to the red list of threatened species and categorized as endangered for the first time by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. That's two steps from extinct. In the wild, scientists blame the monarch's plummeting number on habitat loss, climate change, pesticides, and herbicide usage. What can home gardeners do to support the monarchs? If everyone reading this planted one milkweed plant, the benefit would be palatable. Milkweed is the only plant monarch caterpillars eat, and it's where the adult butterflies lay their eggs. Without it, the species simply could not exist. But not all milkweed is the same, says Dawn Rodney, Chief Innovation and Growth Officer at the National Wildlife Federation in Western Virginia. For instance, there's an invasive species called tropical milkweed that we see more and more, and people are not understanding that it does more harm than good. The non-native plant is problematic because it blooms for longer and in temperate regions does not die back. That can prevent butterflies from recognizing when it's time to migrate, and it can spread deadly parasites to the next year's generation of caterpillars. To choose the right milkweed, use the National Wildlife Federation's Native Plant Finder, and that is www.nwf.org/native-plant-finder. Adult monarchs need other plants too, specifically ones with nectar-bearing flowers. The National Wildlife Federation also has a monarch nectar plant list also. Choose plants native for your region for the highest quality food source. Be sure to include late season bloomers to provide monarchs with fuel for their annual fall migration. The National Wildlife Federation does have a monarch nectar plant list, And that would be www.nwf.org/garden/4/wildlife/about/native-plants/monarch-nectar-guides, developed with Monarch Joint Ventures and Xeres, I'm going to spell that, X-E-R-C-E-S, Society, to find plants appropriate for your location. Know the source of your plants. There are a lot of growers that use different types of chemicals, and they are harmful to wildlife, Rodney said, referring to pesticides and herbicides intended to keep plants attractive on retail shelves. When you bring treated plants home, and butterflies lay eggs on them, the caterpillars that follow will die when they munch the leaves. Neonicotinoid pesticides are especially harmful to the species, Rodney said, as they can kill bees and adult butterflies that ingest the toxin pollen and nectar of treated plants. Since treated plants aren't labeled as such, Rodney advises asking garden center staff about their pest management practices, buying only from trusted organic sources, or growing your own plants from seed are other good options. This brings me to pesticide use in the home garden. When we use chemicals on our plants, we accept beneficial insects, including monarchs, as collateral damage. We also endanger birds that eat those poisoned insects. Even natural and organic pesticides can harm butterflies and other pollinators. But if you must use such a product, stick with the insecticidal soaps, horticultural oils, or neem oil, and apply them only after dusk when pollinators aren't active. Unlike many synthetic chemicals, these products lose their effectiveness when dry, so the butterflies will be safer by morning. Finally, consider going the extra mile by setting up a butterfly puddling station. Create a mud puddle or add water to sand in a sunny spot of the yard and set a flat stone within it. Butterflies will sun themselves on the stone to raise their temperatures and will sip water from the puddle to supplement their nectar diets with salts, vitamins, and minerals that they need. And let's continue with environmental issues and articles. As species recover, some threaten others in more dire shape. Glen Arbor, Michigan. Concealed behind trees near Lake Michigan, two scientists remotely manipulated a robotic owl on the forest floor. As the intruder flapped its wings and hooted, a merlin guarding its nest in a nearby pine sounded distress calls. The small falcon dove forward the enemy, toward the enemy, and into a net that Smithsonian interns Tim Ballward and Zachary Bardner had stretched between the steel poles. They disentangled the merlin, then attached a leg band and transmission unit to trace its movements. The mission will enhance knowledge of a species still recovering from a significant drop off of caused by pesticides, including DDT, which was banned back in 1972 after harming many birds of prey. It also is helping Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore managers protect the piping plover, an endangered shorebird that merlins eat. Merlins are a big threat to their recovery, said Nathan Cooper, research ecologist with Smithsonian's Natural Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute. The situation's ironic. A troubled species rebounds thanks to restoration efforts, only to make things worse for others in perils by preying on them or outcompeting them for food and living space. Similar circumstances have turned up elsewhere, challenging wildlife experts who want them all to thrive in balanced, healthy environments. The iconic bald eagle's comeback has pressured rare water birds. Resurgent peregrine falcons menaced endangered California least terns and western snowy plovers near San Diego, Off the California coast, attacks from protected white sharks hinder recovery of threatened sea otters. Gray seals, previously on the brink of extirpation in New England waters, now occupy some Massachusetts beaches by the hundreds. The 800-pound mammal's return has raised worries about vulnerable fish stocks. Such unintended consequences don't necessarily reveal flaws in the U.S. Endangered Species Act or conservation programs, experts go on to say. Rather, they illustrate that nature's complexity and the importance of protecting biological communities, not just individual species. Clearly, there are occasions when we get these conflicts between species that we're trying to protect, said Stuart Pym, a Duke University extinction specialist. But is it a major worry in conservation? No. Species recoveries can produce trade-offs, as some animals are more adaptable than others to changes in the climate or landscape, said Bruce Stein, chief scientist with the National Wildlife Federation. A lot of ecosystems where these things are occurring are a little out of whack to begin with because we've altered them in some way, Stein went on to say. The Great Lakes region has an estimated 65 to 70 pairs of piping plovers. They're among three remaining North American populations. Their decline caused primarily by habitat loss and predation. Meanwhile, Merlin numbers in the region have jumped. They're suspected of killing at least 57 adult plovers, Cooper went on to say. Data from the transmitters might help determine whether relocating them is worth trying, said Vince Cavallari, a biologist with the National Lakeshore. Recovery of America's national bird, the bald eagle, is a triumph. But in one area of coastal Maine, it poses a problem for only U.S. breeding populations of gray cormorants. When they're disturbed by eagles, the adults will flush and leave their nests, said Don Lyons, a conservation scientist at the National Audubon Society Seabird Institute. Gulls, ravens, and crows gobble abandoned cormorant eggs and chicks. If this happens repeatedly, an entire colony can fail, said Lyons, whose team organizes volunteers to scare away eagles. In Southern California, least terns and snowy plovers are no match for attacking peregrine falcons, which, like eagles, bounce back after the DDT ban. Such pesticides cause large birds to produce eggs with thin shells, which females crush when trying to incubate them. The San Diego Zoo and Wildlife Alliance tries to protect the endangered birds by hiring a falconer to capture problem peregrines for release elsewhere. Hunting and bounties devastated New England's gray seals. Legally protected since 1972, the population has rebounded to tens of thousands. Fishing groups contend that the seals could threaten cod stocks that regulators are struggling to rebuild from overfishing. Gray seals are certainly this case, where recovery has both been cause for celebration and cause for concern, said Christina Kamen, a University of Maine marine mammal scientist who says that they're less of a hazard to fish populations than humans are. Some reviving species may be found a nuisance to people than a threat to other wildlife. Fish farmers in the South, anglers in the Great Lakes region and Pacific Northwest complain about the double-crested cormorant, a diving bird that gorges on catfish, perch, salmon, and other prized species. Wild turkeys spread across North America before European settlement had dwindled to tens of thousands by the 1930s, disappearing from many states. Now they're hunted in 49 states, so common in New England, they can cause traffic tie-ups. Some hunters say hungry turkeys outcompete ruffed grouse, which are decreasing in parts of their range, including the upper Midwest. Scientists blame habitat loss and climate change. Conflicts between recovering species and ones still in trouble could reflect a return to how things were before humans got in the way, scientists went on to say. When a population gets back to where it's having the same interactions with other organisms as before it went down, that's nature at work, said John Fitzpatrick, director of Cornell University's Laboratory Ornithology. You're listening to the reading of the Daily Nonpareil for the 4th of August, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And I am your reader, Peter Welch. Here are today's obituaries. Ruthie Tweed, age 93, of Council Bluffs, has passed. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. at Hoy Kilnoski, that's K-I-L-N-O-S-K-I, Funeral Home, at 1221 North 16th Street on Thursday, the 4th of August on 2022. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. at Southview Bible Church at 135 Bennett Avenue on Friday, the 5th of August. Interment will be at Ridgewood Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to Southview Bible Church. Norman Knott Jr. has passed on July 31st at the age of 58. Funeral services were held by Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home in Council Bluffs, Iowa on Wednesday on the 3rd of August with a visitation from 12 to 1 p.m. and services followed at 1 p.m. at the funeral home. In lieu of flowers, the family asked that you consider a donation to VODEC. Patricia McCormick has passed at the age of 66 in Council Bluffs at the Jenny Edmondson Hospital. Memorials are suggested to the Midlands Humane Society. Gladys Peterson, age 102, passed away on the 1st of August at Primrose Retirement Community in Council Bluffs, where she had resided for the past 12 years. Gladys will be laid to rest with her husband, Clarence, in Garner Township Cemetery following a luncheon. The family will direct memorials. The visitations will be on Saturday the 10th, followed by funeral services at 11 a.m. Lunch will be served immediately following the funeral in the Cutler O'Neill Community Room. And now let's turn to something that affects each and every one of us. It's money. Recession-proof your life. With economic uncertainty on the horizon, try these 9 safety strategies now. Prices for gas and food and rent are soaring. The Federal Reserve has raised interest rates to the highest level since 2018. The U.S. economy has shrunk for 2 straight quarters. Economists are divided over whether a recession is looming. What is clear is that economic uncertainty isn't going away anytime soon. But there are steps you can take now to be ready for whatever lies ahead. Yiming Ma, an assistant professor at Columbia University, says it's not a question of if, but when a recession will happen. People should prepare by not panicking, she says. If you think recession could destabilize your finances, here are some things you can do to prepare. Number 1, know your expenses and make a budget. Knowing how much you spend every month is key. Ma recommends sitting down and writing out how much you spend day to day. This will help you see what's coming in, what's going out, and which unnecessary expenses you might be able to cut. By understanding what money you are getting and what you are spending, you may be able to make changes to help you through tough times, advises the Federal Deposit Insurance Corps' Money Smart, a financial education program. Number 2, save as you can. The more non-essential expenses you can cut, the more you can save. It's not possible for everyone, but Jean Nathale, co-founder of Troutwood, an app that helps people create financial plans, says it's ideal to budget to save enough to cover basic necessities for 3 to 6 months. Programs such as America Saves, a nonprofit campaign by the Consumer Federation of America, can help create a roadmap. And if you do have a savings account, it's important to check whether your bank gives you a good interest rate. And shop around if it does not, Ma goes on to say. Her advice is to keep an eye on the monthly fees or service charges that might eat into your savings. Number 3, consolidate your loans and don't take out any more. As interest rates rise, experts recommend that you consolidate your loans to have just 1 fixed rate loan and if you can, pay down as much of your debt as possible. Job security tends to be worse when a recession comes. It's not a great time to accumulate debt, Ma goes on to say. But paying off your existing debt is easier said than done. The Federal Trade Commission's consumer advice guide for getting out of debt can help you make a plan. With interest rates high, it's also not a great time to take out new loans for big expenses, like cars. Number four, visit secondhand stores and yard sales. Alan Galen, an in-home caregiver in California, has been affected for months by the rising prices of household staples like groceries, paper towels, and gas for his commute. His son's favorite Hi-C orange juice, which was $1.99 for a six-pack, is now $2.50. Since the start of the pandemic, when Galen cut down from caring for multiple families to a single client to reduce his health risks, his household has dealt with financial instability. One choice he's made is to buy items like clothes or electronics secondhand whenever possible, whether from Goodwill, pawn shops, or Craigslist. And Craigslist allows you to search by area to cut down on driving, which means less gas and inconvenience. Number five, negotiate your monthly bills. Since the pandemic, many companies have updated their relief policies and have become more flexible with users, according to Kaya McAllister Young, director of America Saves. Calling providers of monthly services to negotiate bills, whether it's utilities, phone service, cable, internet, or auto insurance, can lead to meaningful savings, says McAllister Young. Individuals can ask for the best rate, any available discounts, rebates, or coupons that can lead to lowered monthly fees. If a provider is competitive with other companies, there's even a better chance of getting a discount, she added. Number six, switch up your groceries. Grocery shopping with a meal plan, buying generic rather than brand name, or purchasing in bulk are some of the recommendations from the Consumer Federation of America. A lot of stores have price matching, so if you show them a competitor is selling the same product at a lower price, they'll match that, says McAllister Young. You also want to be looking at the stores that are closest to you so you're not spending the extra money you'd save on gas. An alternative way to save money on groceries is to check out food sharing apps such as Olio, O-L-I-O, which connects people around their community to share extra grocery items, and Too Good To Go, where customers can buy businesses' surplus food at a discount. Number seven, look at government assistance programs. Even with these savings and spending practices, a month's wages aren't always enough to cover important expenses. If this is your situation, programs around the country are available to help you. Sometimes there just isn't enough end of the month at the end of the month, said Michael Best, an attorney in the National Consumer Law Center, who works on financial services issues. To make use of these resources, check if you qualify for the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, Farmers Market Nutrition Program, or Homeowner Assistance Fund. All of these are federal programs coordinated by state governments. Some states offer additional local programs for their residents. Number eight, look for community assistance. If you're experiencing food or housing insecurity, look for nonprofit or community organizations around you. From housing support and food banks to utility assistance, nonprofit organizations around the country can help. National organizations, such as Feeding America, host food banks in all 50 states. We're already seeing the community reaching out to us in overwhelming numbers because of what's happening in the country in terms of economic stability, says Kavita Mara of Sake for South Asian Women, an organization that helps domestic violence survivors in New York City. Food assistance organizations such as Ample Harvest, Hunger Free America, and Food Rescue U.S. offer maps that offer users to search a nearby food bank by typing their zip code. And finally, number 9, take care of your mental health. Between worrying about the bills and not knowing what your financial future might look like, your stress levels can go through the roof. It's a hectic existence, Galen says. You have to do a lot of managing, and you have to keep a cool head for the sake of your mental health. And now let's take a look at other news here, this time in St. Louis. Climate deal may help farmers aid the environment. The climate deal reached last week by Senate Democrats could reduce the amount of greenhouse gases that American farmers produce by expanding programs that help accumulate carbon in soil, fund climate-focused research, and lower the abundant methane emissions that come from cows. The bill includes more than $20 billion to improve the agricultural sector's impact on the environment, mostly by expanding existing U.S. Department of Agriculture programs that help farmers change to better practices. Farmers would be paid to improve the health of their soil, withstand extreme weather, and protect their land if the bill is enacted. The roughly $370 billion climate and energy spending deal would bring the country closer to cutting greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2030, according to new analysis. That is something many scientists say is important, and that President Joe Biden promised Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, a long-time holdout on climate legislation, endorsed measures that would benefit electric vehicles, renewable energy, and climate-friendly farming. Agriculture is responsible for 11% of the country's climate warming emissions. The funding would expand programs favored by both environmental groups and the agricultural sector, says Ben Thomas, who focuses on agriculture at the Environmental Defense Fund. They are voluntary. They are incentive-based. They get results in terms of implementing conservation practices on working lands, says Thomas. It's great to see. Thomas said historically, the agricultural sector has not aggressively tackled its contribution to climate change, but that hesitation has shifted in recent years, and more money will accelerate progress. There's a lot of potential, he said. It's worth taking very seriously, Thomas went on to say. Cows belch an enormous amount of methane, and agriculture is responsible for more than one-third of human-caused methane emissions, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. This is a way that people's diets, if they are high in meat or dairy, contribute to greenhouse gas buildup. The bill directs funds towards altering what cows eat to reduce those emissions. On farms, soil can hold or sequester carbon if it is left undisturbed and covered by a crop. Money from the bill will expand programs that help farmers turn their soil less, implement climate-friendly crop rotation practices, and plant cover crops that aren't for harvest but improve soil health. The historic funding validates the fact that these practices are important, said Ramjani Prabhakar, an agriculture and climate policy specialist at the environmental group Earth Justice. Cover crops, for example, are used only by a fraction of farming. If their use were to triple from around 5% of cropland to 15%, it could remove the equivalent of 14 megatons of carbon dioxide per year, roughly the total annual emissions of New Hampshire, according to Kevin Carl, a food and climate researcher at Columbia University. The adoption rate is so low, Carl said. There's a lot of potential improvement. Federal officials already offer farmers help with a variety of environmentally focused issues, including irrigation and fertilizer use, One program helps fund conservation easements for agricultural land. And now let's turn to some other national news, this time in Washington, D.C. Biden signs order on abortion. Moves comes a day after Kansas voted to protect rights. So in Washington, President Joe Biden on Wednesday signed an executive order and aimed in part at making it easier for women seeking abortions to travel between states to obtain access to the procedure. More specifically, one of the directives Biden is issuing will allow states that have not outlawed abortion to apply for specific Medicaid waivers that would, in effect, help them treat women who have traveled from out of state. The order will also call on health care providers to comply with federal non-discrimination laws and streamline the collection of key data and information on Material Health and National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The details were described by senior administration officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss the executive order ahead of a formal announcement. Biden described as a health care crisis, the Supreme Court's decision overturning the landmark 1973 ruling Roe versus Wade, and every part of the federal government does its part at this critical moment where women's health and lives are on line. The order came one day after Kansas voters protected the right to abortion in the conservative state, an outcome that Biden celebrated. Biden signed the order from the White House residence, where he continues to isolate with a rebound case of COVID-19. He participated virtually in a meeting led by VP Kamala Harris. "I wish I was with you in person, quite frankly," Biden went on to say, "but I'm getting there." The new order nonetheless falls short of what many Democratic lawmakers and abortion advocacy groups have demanded of the Biden administration. One chief asked has been for Biden to declare a public health emergency on abortion, which White House officials have said would do little to free up federal resources or activate new legal authorities. Wednesday's order is the latest in a series of executive actions from the Biden administration since the constitutional right to an abortion was eliminated in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization in June. Now let's look at some news briefs. Pelosi, U.S. devoted to democracy. In Taiwan, after a trip that drew China's wrath, a defiant Nancy Pelosi concluded her visit to Taiwan on Wednesday with a pledge that the American commitment to democracy on the self-governing island and elsewhere remains ironclad. Pelosi was the first U.S. House Speaker to visit the island in more than 25 years. And China swiftly responded by announcing multiple military exercises nearby. The speaker's departure for South Korea came just a day before China was scheduled to launch its largest maneuvers aimed at Taiwan in more than a quarter of a century. Before leaving, a calm but resolute Pelosi repeated previous remarks about the world facing a choice between democracy and autocracy. Inspectors okay first Ukraine grain. Istanbul, the first grain ship to leave Ukraine and cross the Black Sea under a wartime deal, passed inspection Wednesday in Istanbul and headed on to Lebanon. Ukraine and 17 other vessels were loaded and waiting permission to leave, but there was no word yet on when they could depart. A joint civilian inspection team spent 3 hours checking the cargo and crew of the Sierra Leone flagged ship Razoni, which left Odessa on Monday carrying Ukrainian corn, a UN statement went on to say. The Joint Coordination Center team included officials from Ukraine, Russia, Turkey, and the United Nations, who signed deals last month to create safe Black Sea shipping corridors to export Ukraine's desperately needed agricultural products as Russia's war upon its neighbors grinds on. In other news, the EPA warned on Wednesday residents who live near medical sterilizing plants in 13 states and Puerto Rico about potential health risks from emissions of ethylene oxide, a chemical widely used in their operations. Oil production. The OPEC oil cartel and its allies decided Wednesday to boost production in September by a much slower pace than in previous months. At a time of high gasoline prices and unstable energy supplies exacerbated by Russia's war in the Ukraine. NATO. The Senate on Wednesday prepared to ratify NATO membership for Finland and Sweden, with overwhelming bipartisan support expected for quickly expanding the Western military alliance in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Pandemic report. New coronavirus cases fell 9% globally last week, while deaths remained stable, according to the latest weekly assessment of the pandemic released Wednesday by the World Health Organization. The UN Health Agency said that there were 6.5 million cases reported last week, with more than 14,000 deaths. Appalachia. Almost a week since floodwaters consumed parts of Appalachia, rescue missions were winding down while supplies continued pouring in to what looms as a massive relief effort. The first round of expenditures from a relief fund opened by Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear were being distributed Wednesday. The money will pay the funeral expenses of flood victims. Western wildfires. The McKinney Fire in North California was still out of control on Wednesday, despite some progress by firefighters who took advantage of thunderstorms that dumped rain and temporarily lowered heat that can help fan flames in the parched region. And in Colorado, Uvalde rekindles school police officers' looming fears. Tony Raymaker averages about 14,000 steps a day as he walks around the Nebraska High School, where he is assigned to work as a sheriff's deputy, greeting students arriving in the morning, wandering the hallway to talk to them, and watching out for those who might be eating alone in the cafeteria. The former Marine and longtime youth pastor keeps his office in suburban Omaha stocked with treats, such as Little Debbie snacks and Pop-Tarts, because eating helps kids in crisis calm down and talk. But in the back of his mind, a thought always looms. What would he do if a gunman attacked the school? The latest reminder of that danger came in May, when 19 children and two teachers were killed in a fourth grade classroom in Uvalde, Texas. The fear that the next shooter could happen in their hallways hangs over school resource officers across the U.S., exacerbating an already difficult job. They're called on to be battle-ready officers whom parents and students can trust to protect them while not making students feel uncomfortable or targeted. Reminders of the threat of school shootings were omnipresent at the recent National Association of School Resource Officers conference in Colorado, where hundreds of officers gathered for training. An exhibit hall featured booths with businesses selling ideas to stop the next school shooter, like door locks and simulation machines to mimic shootings. One business showed off foldable semi-automatic rifles. It said one school resource officer takes in a Hello Kitty backpack to his school in Alabama. Mom and Dad don't want to see this weapon in their school, but it's got to be here, said Don Pose, CEO of Gulf Coast Tactical, which sells the rifles. Officers also sat in on sessions to learn about what went wrong at past school shootings. In one of those, they heard about the failure by a school safety monitor to send out an alert when they initially spotted the Parkland school shooter walking onto the campus. The armed school resource officer accused of hiding during the shooting was later charged with being criminally negligent. In another, they got a briefing on a 2019 school shooting in Colorado in which a private security guard who was secretly armed accidentally wounded two students. A Colorado County sheriff also pointed to a more subtle failure in the response to that failure of 2019. Officers unnecessarily traumatized, evacuated elementary students by having them line up with their hands on their heads, even though authorities knew that the gunmen involved were either teens or adults. That's right there will last a lifetime, Douglas County Sheriff Tony Spurlock said, pointing to the photo of the children. One of them has her hands folded in prayer instead. Later, he said he wanted to encourage school resource officers to use their discretion and find ways to minimize trauma to children. And that does it for the reading of the Daily Nonparallel, Thursday, August 4th, 2022. And I am your reader, Peter Welch, and you're listening to IRIS, which is the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction. And those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.